All right. Well, welcome to Back to School, Strategies to Help Your Child Have a Positive School Experience. We spent about 45 minutes on that title. So that is, if it looks like it was drafted by a group, it was. Trying to figure out how to say this, because we've got a diverse group here. We've got homeschoolers, we've got public schoolers, we've got preschoolers, we've got private schoolers, we've got not in school yet and can't wait till they get in school, a little bit of everything, and we get it. Boy, who's glad summer's over? I mean, I know you had yeah? I mean, every day I'd call Amy about 4 o'clock and she'd say, you know, just X many more days. It's almost like a kid counting down Christmas, right? Because she can't wait for them to get back and learn more. That's what it was all about for us. So, but yeah, tonight, one of the things we found out, this was a great topic for us. We thought, wow, that's going to be a great topic. It's timely, and it is. And then we got into it in terms of putting together some material, and we realized, wow, we could write a book. No, we could write a series of books on this just from an adoption and foster perspective. And so forgive us for what we're going to do. We're going to fly really high, but we've provided at the back of your packet a lot of resources. Not only books, which, you know, you think, okay, great, a book, now I got to read 300 pages to figure out the answer to this one question, kind of needle in the haystack, some great articles, and most importantly, some fantastic websites, particularly as we begin to talk about understanding the process of getting help for your kids, as we talk about advocating for your kids and understanding your rights. Some of these websites go straight to the point in the context of the state of Texas, and can, by age grade, you know, by age and grade, can really help you find and understand what you need. And so we've provided that. You've got it in written form. It's actually already on the website, and all of those underlines are links, and so you can go straight to it. We've made it as easy as we possibly can. But what we're going to do tonight is we are going to just set things up. We're not really the focal point tonight in any sense of the word. We want you to hear from our panel, which is a very diverse panel, and I believe can speak to pretty much every situation in here. But we want to kind of provide some context. And so that's what we're going to do for the next half hour or so. We'll take a break to let you guys clean out the food and drinks that we've prepared, and then we'll get back together, and we'll have about an hour or so with a panel. And if we have time, hopefully we will at the end, we'll open it up to some questions and try to address as many questions as we can, recognizing, obviously, that we're not going to be able to go into every level of depth, but we've tried to provide as much information to help you do that in your own context as possible. So jumping straight in, if this works, and if it doesn't, there we go. Focusing on our kids. This is an evening we're going to focus on education and school experience, but for our kids, recognizing that our kids in some ways are unique. I don't like the word different. I'm not really sure what normal is, so I don't know what different is anymore, but I do know that some of our kids are unique. They have unique histories, and they have unique challenges, and we have unique opportunities to help them. First and foremost, education is a need for our kids, but it's also a right in our system. And so I think it's important to understand that, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. One of the things I find interesting as people begin to think in terms of adoption and foster care and schools is a lot of folks kind of struggle with, well, what do I do with this label of adoption and foster care as it relates to school? And one of the things I want to challenge you with is that we don't view adoption and foster as a label as it relates to school. They're facts. They're facts that point to some other facts that are very relevant to how our kids experience school, what our kids need in school, what we need to ask from the system. And so we're not talking about our adopted kids in school and somehow that's completely different, or that somehow that indicates that they're fragile and so therefore they must be handled with care. But rather, those facts point to other facts that indicate their need and indicate what we need to do as parents to help advocate for them and to help them achieve and help them to grow and learn. Okay? In terms of our children, foster and adopted children, they do have unique histories. I think that's something that we talk about very openly here. We want our parents to understand that, and as a result, they have unique needs. And again, that is important for us to understand. One of our favorite books is Wounded Children, Healing Homes. It's written by Jane Schooler. Jane is going to be the keynote at the conference in October here in a couple of months. And this is one of the quotes from her book that has several chapters in that book that deal with adopted children and foster children and their needs in the school system. She says, "Although we're amazingly resilient beings, our developing brains are affected by trauma, particularly early and chronic maltreatment. For children who have suffered early neglect and abuse, and I would add other types of harm, school can be an enormous struggle because the trauma has affected their brain development. The underlying causes of poor academic performances are often overlooked, the root causes she's speaking of. And the related behaviors take all the precedence as the focus of the interventions and the way that educators sometimes address things. And so what she's talking about there is our kids have unique histories. They have unique needs, and we need to be uniquely insightful about how we partner with and advocate for their development. And so foster children, I think we have to be honest about this. There's some interesting studies. Foster children are even a little bit more unique in this sense. There's some very sobering studies that have recently come out that show that foster children are at a greater risk for dropout rates, and they are also in many states scoring lower. Again, not because of the label, but because of the unique histories. Often these children are bounced around home to home. Often they are bounced around school to school. And that transience in their own life and the uncertainty and the instability often impacts their ability to learn as well as their setting quite a pronounced way. And so I think we have to be very insightful about that and understand that many of our foster kids are at risk, and we therefore have to really take on board this role of being an advocate. And ultimately, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about learning to be an advocate for your child. Now, in that, we're not talking about being an adversary, either with your child or with the school system. Sometimes, I'm a lawyer by training, and so sometimes advocate automatically means, okay, who am I going to fight today, right? And we're really gonna urge against that. And I know that sometimes it's frustrating, whether you're in the foster system or dealing with the educational system or the adoption process or what have you. We're talking about advocating and learning to advocate well. But here's something very important, and I'm not only going to say it once, but I want you to hear me. We cannot expect the educational system and the educators, the good people in that system, to work harder than we are working as parents. I believe that's very, very important. Translated, if we don't understand how to help our kids and create a healing environment at home, then we're really asking far too much of the educational system to do what we are not willing and also doing on a consistent basis ourselves. That's why we have DVDs like Dr. Purvis's DVDs, to kind of give you an overview of what does this look like for me to answer the call that God has given me as a parent, foster parent, adoptive parent, to be the primary change agent, to be that healing agent, sourced in God's strength, but ultimately through our hands and feet for our kids. We need to advocate for our kids in the educational system and in school, whether it's homeschool or private school or public school or preschool, whatever it may be. But we have to be leading the way in the home, and I want to make sure that we're always doing our best. We're working as hard or harder than what we're asking for the system, if you will, to work on itself. So what we're going to do in the next few minutes is we're going to look at a couple of keys to helping us advocate well. That's what we're going to talk about, and Amy's going to start us off with one of, I think, the most important as we do that.
The first one is to be proactive, but I'd even add to that and say not reactive. I think what we find oftentimes is that some parents don't take the initiative to go in and maybe build a relationship with a teacher, with a school staff, with specials teachers, music, art, and PE, because those are a little sometimes more unstructured and harder for our kids. And they don't take the time to do those things. And what ends up happening, the first experiences we have with teachers or principals or assistant principals is when there's trouble. Right? And we're then trying to come in and figure everything out. So being proactive, going in early, talking to your child's teacher, helping them understand. We're going to talk more about how much do you tell and how much do you not, but helping them understand that they do come with a history. And because of that, they bring things with them that are difficult that we're going to have to deal with. And not just waiting till they've been in trouble so much that we have to go up to the school. Does that make sense? So being proactive. Hey, I am not past bribing. Now, you're not supposed to bribe your kids. But seriously, just, giving teachers things every now and then just to show them that you appreciate what they do. I was a teacher for 9 years. It is a hard job. It is a hard job. And I tell you, if I knew then what I know now about kids from hard places, my job would have been so much easier. Because I would have been able to help some kids that I was never able to help. And that I just drove behaviors and drove behaviors and drove behaviors because that's the way you do it in Mrs. Monroe's classroom. And I could have had so much more compassion. And I think about this one little boy that I taught that came from the foster care system, and I'll never forget. his mom talking about how he was tied to his high chair when he was 2 years old because they didn't know what else to do with him. And even that didn't have much of an impact on me, which is kind of sad when you think about it. And I was beaten up by the end of the day every day. Scratches, kicked, hit. And it is just, I think things could have been so different for me, but mostly for him. And he might not have been the brightest child when he left my classroom, but he could have been one of the most changed children when he left my classroom. And he wasn't, because partly because of me, partly because his home life. I mean, there were a lot of things that went on. But I think that developing that relationship with the teacher early on is so, so critical. We'll be in a much better place if we do that, because the teachers then are going to have compassion for our children, hopefully. They're going to want to build more of a relationship. They're going to see the need for the nurture. They're going to see, they will always see the need for the structure probably, but having them see the need for the nurture is so important. And we're going to talk in a few minutes too about how important the relationship between the teacher and the student is for our students, especially for all students, of course, but especially for our kids, so that they feel safe when they're there with their teacher at school, and how learning comes from that. Also, it's easier to be able to go in when you have a relationship with the teachers and the administrators to go in and ask for accommodations to be made for your children. If you wait and then there's a problem and then, you know, you're kind of, now, I want to say bickering, but, you know, you're going back and forth trying to figure out how we're going to make this thing work, and you start saying, can you do this and this and this and this to help them, they're not going to be as willing to probably help you as if you've already gone in and built a relationship with them. So being proactive is really important, and not just being reactive. The next key to help us advocate well is to be a partner, not a pest. So this one follows this really well. And this whole idea, it's really a matter of perspective and approach, right? You want to be able to go in and have that relationship with the teacher and be able to partner with the school. And that doesn't just mean partnering with your child's teacher, but with the whole support system, with the whole support team, whether that's administrators or specials teachers or occupational therapists, speech therapists, all of those things that our kids need in the school system, doing that with all of them. And let's just say that takes a lot of time and effort on the part of the parents to be a real advocate for your child and go in and really advocate in all of those to all those people for your child. Be persistent but not pesky. And you know, there's a fine line, right? That we have to advocate, we have to be persistent. We're trying to get one of our little ones when he was in preschool into speech therapy in our school district. And one of the things we learned is that that's a very long process. It took us a long time. And they have timelines that they have to, in the public school, they have to follow through. Well, we met up to the very last day, I think, because it was like May to November or something before. I started in May, got services in November. It was a long process. And I had to keep calling and keep calling and hoping I wasn't being too pesky. Also, when we finally got in speech therapy, the way that they had kind of always done things was not what was going to work best for him. And so we had to go to an ARD meeting and say, look, I really think this would be better for him if he did this here and then some speech over here. And they said, well, that's never been done before. I said, okay. But that didn't mean it can't be done. Just because you've never done it before doesn't mean it can't be done. Will you please go ask whoever you have to ask to find out? And eventually we worked it all out. But, you know, we didn't come in fighting mad or anything like that. That's not what we're advocating at all. But that you just have to be persistent sometimes.
The next one is that remember that expectations matter. Now, I know as soon as you hear the word expectations in here, you think, here they go again. They're always talking about expectations. Expectations are key to success in this journey of adoption and foster care. And they're also key in terms of encountering and really succeeding in school environments. If you think about it, everybody that's involved comes with expectations. The teachers come with expectations, and their expectations are across an entire classroom, unless you're homeschooling in that sense. And then even then, I think you have a number of expectations when you take off mom hat and put on teacher hat in terms of how you engage your kids. And we've heard this from a lot of homeschooling moms, that sometimes those adoption expectations come kind of crashing in, if you will, in that schooling environment. The kids have expectations. I love this about this quote from Wounded Children Healing Homes again, Jane Schuller's book. She says, intrinsic in the school experience is the phenomenon of uncertainty. School is about something you do not know, something you are uncertain about. Securely attached children tend to approach uncertainty with interest and curiosity. But kids from hard places, they approach uncertainty and it overwhelms them. It can frighten them and even freeze them in their tracks. Since this learning process is, by definition, about not knowing something, we should not be surprised that kids who cannot tolerate the distress of uncertainty will struggle in school. And so we have to begin, going back to being proactive, working with our kids very early to help them know what to expect. With one of our kids who does very well academically, the whole name of the game is knowing what's coming, feeling like he has a little bit of control so that it doesn't create the anxiety and shut him down. We have learned that. He's older now, and so it's taken us many unique grade levels to learn that and to be able to articulate that. But that's the name of the game for him. It's not the schoolwork. It's not the friendships. It's not the behavior problems. It's the anxiety because of what he doesn't know is going to happen. And even though he's in the same school year to year, things change, and that uncertainty is really tough for him. And then obviously we as parents have expectations of our children as well as of the educators. And so I think we have to be very mindful of all those expectations that we bring to these various relationship dynamics, and we have to be very proactive about them. I think one of the important things we have to make clear to teachers in particular is that we're not looking for our kids to be treated as exceptions. That's not what we're looking for at all, going back to the label thing. But we do want them to be understood. We want them to be understood. And Amy's going to talk a little bit about helping our teachers understand that. But that's the nuance. That's the important distinction. And I think as parents, in terms of expectations, obviously this is one of the things where grades come in. And I think particularly for our kids who've suffered harm and who've had trauma and maltreatment in their background, it's important for us, while grades are important, we have to focus on the effort for them. We have to focus on the effort and find the positive in their effort, even as we continue to try to help them grow and develop and achieve all that they can. And so I would encourage you to kind of think through that. As we're getting in, we've been in this grade phase for quite some time. I have to remind myself. In fact, one of mine came home and said, "Dad, I got a 100 on the science test." And my immediate response was, "I'm so proud of you." And then I thought, what am I proud of him for? Am I proud of the 100 or the fact that he was proud of his effort and the result? And I had to kind of catch myself in that. Simple example, but it really begins to play even larger. And especially as kids begin in school, if they've come home older, or they've just come into your care, it's very important, even if they're struggling, that we find ways to praise them for their effort and continue to push them on the effort, on the focus of effort, so that they can, in fact, achieve all that they're capable of achieving. Amy's going to share about the next one.
The next one is to share about your child's history. And this is always a question that comes up when I get phone calls from parents. And I have had many over the last 3 weeks, I have to say. And this is always a question. How much do I share with the teacher? Because we don't want to divulge everything. We've talked about, privacy here. We've talked about all of those things and how, you don't want to share too much because it's your child's story. You're the guardian of that story. But I do think, and most of the things that I have been reading say that you should tell the teacher that your child's a foster child or if they're adopted, even if they look like you, even if they're, were adopted as an infant or whatever, that it's really important for them to know because even, infant adoption, kids that look just like you, there can still be issues that come from their prenatal history. And so we need to let teachers know if our kids are adopted. Then I think we move to what their needs are because of their history. But you don't have to share everything that's in their history. So it may be appropriate as a foster parent to say, they've been in 6 homes and 6 different schools, and so transitions for school are really hard. So what I'd like for you to help me with is that kind of thing. But you don't have to say, their parents beat them half to death and had to, and that's why they're in foster care. That's not relevant information. What's relevant is the fact that they need help. It comes from their history. And that's where we are today. So let's move from here on. So I think that's really important. Another quote from Wounded Children Healing Home that I think is great, that talks about this foundation is about a relationship with the teacher. It says, "Another inherent feature of school is the teacher-student-task relationship. What Getty's, the woman's book that she was referring to, calls the learning triangle." So you've got student, teacher, and task, what they need to do. "A skill is taught through the connection between the teacher and the student. Teachers are more than messengers of academic lessons. They're conduits through which learning takes place. For children who have experienced trauma in their primary attachment, the learning process depends on perceived security of the relationship with the teacher. It is so critical. We've seen it with our own kids. We had a year, and our kids are in a phenomenal school, but we had one year that one of our kids and his teacher, they just didn't click at all. She didn't really get him. He didn't get her. And it just became one of those things that it was a hard year for him. The anxiety level was out the roof. He would not perform. He would not do his work well. He'd get by. And he was capable of so much more. And it's not about he needs to, you know, always want to please the teacher, whatever. But we have found that his teacher makes a huge difference for him. If they can understand him, he can understand. And sometimes our kids aren't easy to understand. They really aren't. They have quirks and, you know, just they're just different kinds of kids sometimes. And so helping the teacher understand those things, being proactive, going in saying, I know that he's going to ask you 15 times in one day if he can take this letter to the PE teacher. If you just let him do it at the beginning of the day, we'll all be good. And we won't have to worry about that because he is going to annoy you. That would annoy me. It annoys me at home. And I've had to learn how to get over it and learn how to deal with that situation. And so, you know, this is a way you could help him out with that. So it's really important to be able to do that. Again, you need to share enough information to build compassion and understanding for your child. Just the other day, I was in an ARD for our littlest one, Carter, for his speech. And I haven't had one of those meetings with his teachers yet. And he's, you know, not big trouble, but, you know, getting in trouble for talking every now and then, you know, over these first few weeks. And his teacher was sitting there, and the speech teacher said, would you explain to them his health issues that he came to you guys with? And I was like, sure. So I started talking about how he was a chronically ill child, major sinus infections, lost hearing because he has so many sets of ear tubes, blah, blah, blah. I mean, she sat there like she couldn't believe it. And I know that she had to have more compassion and understanding for him when she went back to her classroom that day. Because she realized, yeah, now I know why I had to sit him in front. It's not just because he talks if he's sitting in the back. It's because he can't hear me. You know, now I understand why his mom is crazy and says he can't eat anything at school because he's on a very strict gluten-free, dairy-free diet. So just don't feed him anything at school. I'll send everything. You know, I've become kind of one of those moms that none of us ever thought we'd be. But you find yourself there to be able to advocate well for your kids. On the age of your child sometimes depends on what you share. So for an older child, you might share that they did live in an orphanage situation for so many years. But you don't have to give them all the details of what happened to them in the orphanage. Foster, talk about that they're currently in foster care, maybe how many times they've moved around, but not necessarily what got them put into foster care. And once again, the adopted domestic infant is still very important for us to share, even if they look like you, that they are adopted.
Yeah, imagine if you think the adoptive domestic infant situation is kind of exempt, and maybe you have an open relationship, and so your child has a birthday party at which birth parents are there, they go back to school, and their teacher asks, how was your birthday party? And they say, it was fantastic. Mom and Dad were there, and Susie, my birth mom, was there, and Joe, my birth father, and my birth grandparents. Most teachers would, you know, eyes would pop out. And that's just probably some awkwardness that you can avoid. And so it's relevant for all of our kids. It's relevant for all of our kids in those situations. The next one, and I'm not going to spend a ton of time because we could talk all night about understanding the process for obtaining help. and then the next one after that about knowing your rights. Here's what I'm going to say. Start early. Start before, let's say you're about to adopt, or you're about to bring a child home, or you're about to receive a foster placement. Go ahead and start getting familiar with all this now. Because if you start today, and the needs are present today, let's say you bring a child in, or you begin to see needs and say, I need help today, you will not get help today. You will not get help tomorrow. You will not get help next week. And that's not somebody else's fault. That's on us. We're going to have to, that's the way the system works. And we can go through the process to get the help. It's available, but we've got to start early, and it's going to take time. Amy told you that we started in May to get speech therapy, and we were late. We had kind of, oh, it's no big deal. He'll grow out of it, you know, and it got worse and worse and worse. So when we finally started, we needed it yesterday, and we didn't get it until 6 months later. That was not the system's fault. That was our fault. And so what we're encouraging you to do is understand the process. Again, one of the best resources I can point you to, if you live here in Texas, obviously, which I assume you do, is not with me because I didn't bring it up here, but it's TexasProjectFirst.org. TexasProjectFirst.org. It's on your resource list. It is a parent-led site put out by the Texas Education Agency, and it has phenomenal information. You want to know step by, if you're a step-by-stepper, I want to know one, then two, then three, it'll lay it out for you in excruciating detail. You say, I want to know a step-by-step for a third grader, just plug in third grader, it'll lay it out for you. And it'll take you through the state law, it'll take you through the process of obtaining help, the timelines, your rights, etc. Get familiar with that. Go ahead and get onto that. Learn these terms, an ARD and an IEP, and what, you know, when does one happen to the other, and you know who just ARD'd me, and all that kind of thing. That's going to be relevant. And so understand that process. Use that resource list, Texas Project First. There's some other websites as well, but that's one I really found to be the most informative, and get your arms around that as soon as you can. And in terms of knowing your rights, sometimes you're not going to get the answer that you think you need, and sometimes you're not going to get the answer that you think you're entitled to get. And sometimes that may be true. That never gives you an excuse not to be respectful and civil and to continue to come back and partner to be an advocate, not an adversary. So we're always coming at it from that perspective. But you need to understand your rights, and you have rights, because, again, education is a necessity and a need, but it's also a right in our system. And so it's important that you understand your rights. Again, those same resources will help you do that. To pursue them, and to be willing to seek help. There are people, there are attorneys and others who specialize in helping parents understand and protect their children's educational rights in the system. Not, again, in terms of necessarily becoming adversarial, but in terms of very, very forcefully advocating for their kids and everything their kids need in the system. And so I want to encourage you to understand that if you can't get to the right place, and you're not getting what, in fact, you should be getting for your child to help them, then there are some folks out there that can help you, and we've provided you some resources on that. Again, we could spend all night long on that. I don't intend to, but I want to make sure you're aware of that. And the key is to start early, to start now, if you think you're going to have a need, and certainly if you already have a need, to begin now.
All right. Our next key is handle labels with care. I think labels can be helpful in providing services for our kids. We just have to be really careful that the label doesn't start to define who our children are, and certainly that it doesn't start to, for them, define their self-worth. So we have to be really careful with labels. We're not against labels by any means, because some of our kids need labels to be able to get the services that they have to have and for us to get what's right for them in the school system. But the problem is that we can't go too far with it, because if we do, then not only sometimes do we start calling on that label and saying, well, they can't do that because they're ADHD, you know, or they're not capable of this because they're, you know, they have RAD, or, you know, whatever the case may be. You've got to be really, really careful with that, because it could start for us to define who our kids are to us, but then also their own self-worth, and we certainly would never want that. And so handle labels very, very carefully. The next key to help you advocate well is to remember the two-thing rule. So when you go to approach a teacher with the help that you are wanting for your child, don't go to them with a stack of books or a stack of DVDs or a stack of articles, because trust me, they have enough to do already. They are not going to have time unless they ask you for it. Now, I've had teachers ask me, I'd love to understand this better. Would you bring me a book, an article or something?
You should have never done that.
Yeah, that's a bad idea. But unless they ask you for it, the best thing to do, I think, is to give them two things that they can do for your child in the classroom. And most of the time, those two things are going to be helpful for all the kids in the classroom. So some of our friends, they had a little boy who, when he was highly anxious, his voice was really high-pitched. And so one of the things that they had been working on at home, always use things you're doing at home so they're obviously familiar for your child when they're at school, is saying soft and low. soft and low when his voice got really loud and high-pitched. And so they asked the teacher, would you please use the word soft and low whenever his voice goes really high and loud? And so she said, yes, I can do that. And that's a simple thing that a teacher can do, that you are carrying over something from home to school that they will be able to use easily. And so she started doing it, and a few weeks later she came back to this mom and she goes, it is working great for all the kids. Like, she loved the idea. It was very simple, simple terminology. Kids understood it, and it was working. So pick one or two things. That's just one example. For our kids, for Carter, he has some oral sensory issues, and we went to his kindergarten teachers last year when I went up the very first couple weeks of school. He wasn't sitting on his bottom in circle time, which they're okay with as long as he's not, you know, wiggling everywhere. He was on his knees, and they were okay with that. But I saw him with his hand, I mean, practically his whole hand in his mouth, just chewing his nails. And I knew what that meant for him. And that's just high anxiety for him. And so what we did is started doing some research, and we found this organization that sells this stuff called Chewlery. And it is, they're little necklaces and bracelets and things that you can buy that are kind of like, you know, the little keychains you can put on your wrist that are stretchy, the circular ones, it's the spiral ones. They're like that, just really heavy duty. And so we bought those for Carter and took him to the, you know, talked to his teachers and said, this is the second thing we need, please, is if you'll let him chew on this, because he's already a sick kid and he's getting sicker and sicker because his hands are in his mouth all the time, and we know that's why. And so can you please let him wear this? And they were very gracious and said, absolutely, we can do that. Now, of course, we need to tell you that if he starts playing with it, you know, if he's not using it for what it's meant for, we're going to have him put it in his cubby. I said, I'm perfectly fine with that. And that happened one time all year, and he wore that necklace all his kindergarten pictures. He's got that necklace on. He wore it all year long and did really, really well because of that. And so it doesn't have to be a ton of stuff. You can just pick two or three things where you can go in and say, these would really help. These are things we're doing at home. You could carry it over at school. It would be really helpful for us.
On that point, I want to point out that many of our kids, in fact, the majority of our kids deal with some sensory processing deficits. And some of them have it so pronounced that it's actually sensory processing disorder. If you as a parent are not very familiar with that and have tools and strategies for that, let me encourage you to get a hold of the Out of Sync Child, which is kind of considered the sensory processing Bible, if you will. We have copies over there. But I think more practically for us in the school setting is a book that Carol Kranowitz, who wrote The Out of Sync Child, also put together called Answers to Questions Teachers Ask About Sensory Integration. What's great about this is it's all very practical, implementable stuff, if you will, checklists and forms and suggestions, and it goes from kindergarten, preschool actually, all the way through high school. The reality is that many of our kids, if they've never had any type of therapy or intervention regarding sensory processing, they can be in junior high and high school and still be dealing with a ton of sensory processing deficits and issues, over responsiveness, etc. And that can impact behavior, that can impact social relationships, it can impact, obviously, their ability to pay attention and to learn, so on and so forth, even movement in the hallway and what have you. It's very, very pervasive in kids from hard places. It's very pervasive in the foster and adoption population. And so if you don't understand and don't have insight in terms of sensory processing, please, please, please get some information about that and understand that it is a well-understood area and there are a lot of very accessible helps. What we find is that when people implement the two-thing rule, almost always, especially for younger kids, but all the way through high school, almost always one of those things has to do with sensory processing. And again, there are some very readily available helps out there. And so let me encourage you to get up to speed on that if you can.
And I'll tell you also, one of our kids, when he was in second grade, he was still having a lot of trouble sitting still and all of those things. But we know his history, so we know it's not true ADHD. We know where it comes from and what is going on. And so we knew we were kind of at that point. We were getting ready to have that, you know, the teacher was either going to come to us about, you know, he's moving all the time and we're having trouble staying focused and whatever. And just best teacher ever. And we said to her, we said, we totally get it. Like, we understand he's impulsive. He's all of these things. But if you could help us out, when you see him like that, when you see him, you know, first of all, they're so good about, I mean, he always sat on his knees in his chair. And she was like, I can deal with that. That is okay. So that was a good thing. If he had to sit on his, he still sits on his knees when he eats dinner. I don't get it, but For him, that works best. So, and I said, when you see him being real fidgety, can you let him go get a drink of water? Can you let him go? And she goes, I've got a great idea. We're kind of working through this sensory thing. She goes, I'll give him kind of a bag with a lot of books in it that's heavy, so a good sensory input. I'll send him to an office, to the office, with a note that says, send him right back. And then he can come back to me. And so he kind of worked out this deal that when he was too antsy, too fidgety, that we had this thing that he'd take some books and, you know, or do an errand for her or something to try to help him get some of that energy out so he could come back and he could refocus.
Plus, he thought he was special, too. So
that didn't
work great.
And one other one I wanted to talk about, too, for kids that have learning disabilities, that sometimes, you know, things like using bookmarks or paper to cover the lines where they're only reading one line at a time and they're not seeing all the other letters. Things like that are little things that can be done that hopefully teachers know those kinds of things, but sometimes it's like, pull out your textbook, you know, no one's thinking about it. And if they could just be told, for him, if he could keep these papers in his desk so he can, you know, follow along better, that would be helpful. So just little things like that. Leave school at school is our next one. Now, this one's a difficult one for parents, and I think it totally takes you sitting down with the teacher and talking to them about this. And I'm seeing some moms in here. They're laughing because we've had this conversation. If your child is getting in trouble at school, and every time they come home, they're getting in trouble at home for what they did at school, every single day, over and over, what do you think they think about both home and school? Neither one's a very fun place to be, and it certainly isn't very safe because they're yelling at me all the time because I'm getting in trouble at school, and then I come home and I have to get it. So they don't want to come home, and they don't want to go back to school the next day because they know it's going to happen. And it's, we're defeating ourselves. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't times, and we definitely are partnering with the schools and, you know, all of that, and I'm not saying just let stuff go. But, you know, if you're getting a note home, he talked too much today, you know, or now if they're hitting kids and, you know, I mean, y'all know the difference. That's if they're hitting kids, if they're aggressive, if they've been sent to the principal's office, you know, those things are different. But just the everyday little things, talk to the teacher about, tell me when you need me to intervene at home. You know, whether that's put a little star on the folder, like, please talk to them about this tonight type thing. Tell me when you really need me versus when you're handling it well at school and you don't need me to nitpick every single little thing at home too. Does that make sense? So that's really important.
That doesn't mean don't help them with their homework. We're not saying that.
No.
But leave the behavior issues at school at school.
The next one is take diversity and bullying seriously. I think you have to think very carefully through, especially if you're a transracial family, about where your kids are going to school. We are very fortunate our kids, all of our kids are Hispanic, and they're in a very ethnically diverse school, which is perfect for them. They do not stand out. They look like everybody else there. But it's really important for you to think through that when you're thinking about schools. It may help you make a decision to homeschool instead. I don't know. Or finding a private school that has more ethnic diversity if your public school doesn't. If your school is not diverse, sometimes what happens is that your kids will end up being bullied or made fun of because they look different than everybody else, right? I mean, our kids already, it's hilarious. I'll never forget when Miles was in kindergarten. I think some of y'all have heard me say this before, but there was this little girl from Korea, and every time I came to the classroom, which was a lot because I worked up there a lot, she would go, "You're Miles's mom?" I'd say, "Yes, Anna, I'm Miles' mom." And she'd ask me again, "You're Miles' mom? Like, how could you possibly be his mom?" And I said, "Yes, sweetie, I'm his mom." One day, Miles had had enough. And he took my hand, and he took his hand, and he put them together, and he goes, "Anna, my mommy is Peach, and I am brown." And she was like, "Okay." And she never asked again. And the most hilarious thing is she was so unsure that we were not sure that we didn't look alike. She wanted to make sure that we knew it. Once we knew it, she was fine. And so it's even in an ethnically diverse school, if your parents don't look like the child or if the siblings don't look alike. Miles and Grant at school have had a lot of people say things like, "How can that be your brother?" You know, they've been there long enough now, people know, and it doesn't matter. But at the beginning, that was kind of hard for them. So this resource, we've talked about it before, is great. It's called the Wise Up Power Book. The Wise Up Power Book teaches your children how to engage other people about their adoption story. So it talks about feelings they may have. A lot of it revolves around school, and it helps them understand. W stands for walk away. That's an option they have when people ask them or being nosy about their adoption story. What's this one? I forget because Miles calls it something else.
It's private, but Miles calls it, it's none of your business. So either way.
That's what always comes to my head when I think about it. The S is for share information, and the E is for
educate.
Others. And so you can help walk through this with your kids. We have done it with our kids. It's worked really well for them so that when they get in those situations, they know what they can say and they're not stunned by it. You know, you and your brother don't look alike. I know we're adopted. Or they can choose to walk away and not engage the person on it. So they can share, they can walk away. You know, so it's really, or they could say, I don't want to talk about that. And just helping your kids have the words so that they are empowered then to be able to talk about their own story with others is really important. Over on the table, we have the Power Book for foster care. There's one specifically for foster care and one for adoption. We don't have any adoption ones, but you can order it from adoptionsupport.org, and you can get it there. But they're great, or on Amazon too. But they're workbooks that are kid-friendly, that take them through. And one of the things I love about it is that it takes them through lots of feeling scenarios. Because how do you feel when someone said to you, you and your brother don't look alike? How can you be brothers? And you talk through that kind of stuff. And then bullying is one of those things that many, many, many schools are learning a lot about, whether it's bullying because they're adopted and they look different and all of those things, or just in general. And so always, always be an advocate for your kids. This has happened to us this year with one of ours, and I started off, you know, talking to the teachers in the places that it was happening. But of course, our child didn't want them to say anything because they were afraid that it would get worse if they said something to the child. So I just keep your eyes open kind of thing. It wasn't horrible stuff, but, and then it just went a little bit too far. And so I went to the principal and talked to him about it, and he was very gracious and talked to the child. We haven't had any problems since. And so it's not something that you have to totally flip out about, but at the same time, I think you as parents know when it's gone too far. The key is to getting your kids to talk to you about it. We went a year before our child told us the first time. He told us at the very beginning of this year and said it happened all last year. We had no idea. So just know, whether it's adoption related or it's not, that that's something you have to take very seriously. Because I think a lot of our kids, we've talked about this before, kids that come from hard places already have kind of this shame core. And when someone's making fun of them and bullying them and only doing it to them and whispering it in their ear so no one else can hear, you know, it just builds on that shame core. And we don't want to do that for our kids. So
That's it. So be sure and look at the resources. We have a short list there, but then we have the longer list for you, and that's online to help you with. We're going to take about a 5-minute break, and then we're going to put the panel up here. So get something to eat, get something to drink, and we'll meet you back here in about 5 minutes.